I'm excited to welcome my next guest. We're going to have a great discussion on global issues. His name is Dr. Augusto Lopez Claros. He has written a new book called Global Governance and the Emergence of Global Institutions for the 21st Century. It was published by Cambridge University Press. You really don't get any more prestigious than that. He has had an amazing career with organizations like the World Bank and the IMF. He has served at the absolute top levels of those organizations, in addition to being an incredible professor and, of course, author. He has written quite a few books on the international system from various perspectives and, of course, many academic articles. Professor Lopez Claros, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Thank you very much, Jim. I'm fine. Thank you.
All right. So I want to let you know off the top so that you don't feel like you're getting, blindsided, that I'm not a fan of the global anything right now. The global institutions to me seem to have failed. What's your perspective, please, sir?
I think you have to take a kind of a long-term perspective in discussing our current international sort of global architecture. 2020 is an interesting year to be raising these kinds of questions because it's the 75th anniversary of the creation of the United Nations. As you know, this was very much an American-led effort. It was Franklin Roosevelt who, in 1945, set in motion a process of building up institutions that would allow us to cooperate internationally to tackle important global issues. At that time, in 1945, essentially it was peace and security. Against the background of 60 million fatalities in World War II, there was a sense very much at the White House, in the U.S. Congress, in Europe and in other places in the world, that we needed to establish a more secure basis for peace and security because we did not wish to have a World War III now with nuclear weapons. And so the United Nations was an important first step in trying to solidify and establish a basis, for international cooperation in the future. Today we have, we still have the issue of peace and security, but we have other problems which were not in the radar screen in 1945. Things like climate change, like inequality, like nuclear proliferation, and so on. And in the book, we make the case that these problems can only be solved in the context of greater international cooperation. Nations talking to each other, finding areas of common interest, and finding solutions to these problems, which cannot be solved purely through national domestic policies. We accept and speak quite openly of many of the flaws of the United Nations system and other multilateral institutions. But I think that the solution is not to do away with them. The solution is to strengthen them, is to find better ways of collaborating at the international level to solve these problems. Let me give an example of what I mean, why the current system is not working very well. And in that sense, I have sympathy for the thought that you expressed at the very beginning, namely that the system has failed us. I think I would agree with that. The system has failed us. And the example that I will give you is in 2015, 175 governments came together in Paris to sign this Paris Agreement on climate change. And it was an important moment because it was a recognition by the heads of state of virtually every country in the world, that we have a problem, we need to confront it, we need to do something about it. But literally the day after the agreement was signed, the scientific community was already saying, this is not going to work. First of all, the commitments made were completely voluntary. Second, in other words, no penalties for failing to fulfill those commitments on reducing emissions. Secondly, and this is an important point, even if every country did what they committed to do, if you added up all those commitments and you said everybody's going to behave perfectly in agreement with what they have signed on to, it's not going to work. The global temperatures are going to rise beyond the 2-degree level, which hasn't happened in the last 3 million years. And so the scientists were saying we're entering into uncharted territory. And what has happened, of course, since 2015 to the present is that emissions have continued to rise every year. And we are worse off in terms of the prospects for climate change today than we were 5 years ago. So the system is obviously not working, right? But the answer is not to stop cooperating, to stop talking to each other. The answer is to strengthen the system, to find meaningful ways of strengthening the global architecture for international cooperation that we have today to address these problems, because these problems are not going to go away unless we tackle them in some fundamental way.
Okay, I need you to, you've said this twice and I wrote it down both times, strengthen them. So I can't wait to hear what your thoughts are on this. To me, the strengthening needs to be that the lies need to stop, and we need to be that they need to be more apparent. And when I think of examples like, and again, I'm just a normal guy sitting in the middle of America. I have no access to real data or real information. What I hear, though, from the press, and I don't believe much of it, but I see a lot of it, and at some point you have to start wondering if it's true, that that certain governments had too much influence in our health organizations, and that led to mass uncertainty, that governments can impact health-related organizations by the amount of influence they have and force them not to say certain things, or that when the entire General Assembly gets together and votes, that one country can have a veto over the entire process, and that country is the country that's so should be denounced, but they still have a veto. The system seems to me just to be just wrong from the beginning. You know, I don't know how strengthening it works. So define that term for me, please. Understanding that I'm just a common guy who sees this stuff and goes, that's a bunch of BS.
Yeah. Look, you know, some of the observations that you make are I think, broadly on target. Let's talk about the veto in the United Nations. You are absolutely right. When the United Nations adopted the UN Charter, which is like the constitution of the United Nations, in 1945 at a conference in San Francisco, right? They created a system which essentially gave veto power to 5 countries, the so-called permanent members of the UN Security Council.
Right.
The United States, at that time the Soviet Union, China, the United Kingdom and France, right? And, this has remained an important flaw of the system because it is completely undemocratic. It is a system where if a country is not in support of a particular initiative or decision taken by the majority, they can simply veto and nothing is done, right? It is a very good example of something that is a total contradiction of not only the spirit of democracy, but also, current broadly accepted principles of good governance, right? And so people who look at that, you know, can dismiss the United Nations and say, look, this organization is not credible. As long as it allows a country, let's say Russia or China, to veto the decisions of the entire international community. However, having said that, and even if you accept, and I do accept, that as being a very important flaw, right, the United Nations has done many good things over the last 75 years. They, for instance, manage the entire process of decolonization, whereby small nations in Africa and in other parts of the world that were colonies of the United Kingdom, were colonies of France, gain independence and became full members of the United Nations with sovereign rights and privileges. The United Nations has been very instrumental over the last 75 years in developing an architecture for protecting human rights. They don't always do it well, but it's a lot better today than it was back in 1945, I assure you, especially if you are members of persecuted religious minorities, ethnic minorities, and so on. At the moment, part of the challenge that we have in these institutions, whether the UN system or its agencies like the World Health Organization and so on, is that they don't have sort of full democratic legitimacy. You mentioned the General Assembly. In the General Assembly, the people who sit there are essentially diplomats. They are representatives of the party in power back at home. And that is why in the book, we have an entire chapter where we present proposals to strengthen the democratic legitimacy of the United Nations by establishing a closer linkage between the organization and people like you and me, who are very detached from it. We think that we should have a say in how these organizations are run, and we have proposals to that end. My point, and I don't disagree with your concerns about inefficiencies and flaws in the way these organizations have been designed and operate. I am sympathetic to your concerns, but my point essentially, and the point in the book, is that we need to look forward. We need to accept that these global problems, which I have mentioned, climate change, inequality, poverty, related to climate change, we have a whole range of other issues, you know, rising sea levels, biodiversity loss, the increasing evidence of extreme weather events and all these things. These are existential threats to mankind. These are going to affect everybody, poor countries, rich countries, you in Middle America, and people living in the East Coast and in the West Coast and in Europe and in Asia and in Africa. And unless, you know, we accept that these problems require working across national borders, require governments coming together to implement initiatives on a collective basis, our future is going to be very dark. We are at a crossroads. Either we come together and we confront these issues in a collaborative way, or we go our own way, and then basically they're going to hit us very, very hard in coming years and are going to bring a great deal of suffering and disruption and instability in the world.
Well, I do agree with that. I do agree that it's going to take nations working together. I don't know that there's enough power to force China to actually do anything. You know, I have huge lack of faith in, say, carbon credits, because I've seen what China does and how they get around the system and make the entire system look foolish, in my opinion. So, I agree with you. I think that a big organization needs to do it. I just don't know. I have doubts. Augusto, I want to throw out a crazy idea to you and get your response to my crazy idea, okay?
All right.
New York City doesn't like having the United Nations there because you don't pay your parking tickets. You owe New York City $1 billion. There seems to be places in the earth where everyone wants to fight over. And at my house, when two children want to fight over something, the easiest way to solve the problem is to take it away from both of them. I think that the United Nations should move to Jerusalem and make all of Jerusalem a global city under the auspices of no one. The Jews don't get it. The Israelis, the Palestinians, no one is in power there. And then we solve a lot of problems and we got better parking in New York City. What do you think?
It's an interesting idea. You know, if you go back to the history, of course, the reason why the United Nations is in New York is basically because that was the preference of the American government at the time of the creation of the United Nations. Remember, the UN was an American creation. It was
I remember. Yes.
Yeah, it was an initiative of Franklin Roosevelt working together with Winston Churchill, who were the two leading powers fighting against the Nazis and the so-called Axis powers. Moving the UN headquarters somewhere else in the world, you know, I think that in this age of communications technology and you know, instant networking, where the UN headquarters is actually physically located is going to matter less and less. And therefore, if the membership at one point decided that, look, New York City is very crowded and it's very expensive and you know, diplomats have to pay very high rents for their dwellings and so on, let's take the UN to Africa or to Jerusalem or to Australia, I certainly wouldn't have any problems with that. It will have to be a concerted decision. It will have to involve all the members in some kind of democratic vote. But if that is the consensus, if one can run the UN at lower cost somewhere else, maybe in the developing world, or to take your example, Jerusalem, why not? I don't have any problems with that in principle. I just want to remind you that the UN is in New York because the American government wanted it to be.
Oh, I know. I know. And I'm sure that it was because that piece of land was easily available and American officials got kickbacks when the real estate deal was closed. I'm sure that there was some sort of nebulous thing like that. What are your thoughts on New World Order?
Look, Do you remember 1991 and the task force that was put together by then President George Bush, the
yes.
father, to essentially bring nations together in a joint military force to kick Saddam out of Kuwait? Do you remember that?
Yes, very well.
It was a very, very good example of what I call international cooperation, right? It was nations coming together under the auspices of the United Nations. Remember, George Bush had been the American ambassador at the UN, so he was very conscious of the importance of international law.
And the head of the CIA.
That as well. You know, George Bush had a very big curriculum. But in particular, he had been at the UN, and he understood the importance of giving legitimacy to that international task force by getting the endorsement of the United Nations Security Council. Well, the term New World Order was actually coined at that time. There is a speech of George Bush somewhere in the archives where he actually uses that term to signify a different way of doing things, right? In other words, instead of the U.S. just going it alone and acting unilaterally to remove Hussein from Kuwait, George Bush thought that there was a value in bringing nations together in a powerful statement of rejection of Hussein and his very arbitrary break with international law. And he used the term a new world order to essentially highlight that in the future, nations working together and collaborating in the context of some framework like the United Nations was the way to go. And from that perspective, you know, I am sympathetic to that definition of world order if it means, you know, nations coming together and cooperating, you know, in the common interest of humanity, as we have to do now with climate change, for instance.
So one of the, I alluded to a minute or two ago, one of the things that's bothered me has been the National Health Organization and the response to the pandemic. I don't think they did a very good job. Again, it's just from what I read, not, you know, knowing the people like you do. What are your thoughts on the National Health World Health Organization, and what grade do they deserve? I would give them a low D. What would you give them?
It has not been one of the great moments of the World Health Organization, to be frank with you. In that respect, I tend to sympathize with your views. I don't know whether I would give them as low as a D, but when you look at what the World Health Organization has done in its many decades of history, it has had some great moments, right? They led the effort to eradicate smallpox. You know, until the 1960s and 70s, how many people used to die every year of smallpox? 2 million, right? 2 million people every year, right? In other words, at that time, we had a coronavirus crisis every year in and year out. And it was basically the World Health Organization working with its members, with the United States, with the United Kingdom, with countries in Africa, that essentially completely eradicated smallpox by the 1980s, right? So that was a great moment. It was a very, very good example of how international cooperation can work very effectively, right? So having said that, one does wish that the World Health Organization had been more efficient, more open, since last December when there was evidence that we had a global pandemic. I think that they were slow to react. I think some people have criticized them for having taken, perhaps with a little bit too much credence, the limited information coming out of China, right? But look, it is the organization that we have. Pandemics are not going to go away, that's for sure. You have to understand the origin of pandemics, right? It is partly linked to what we're doing to the planet Earth, right? We have huge population growth. By the end of this century, we're going to have 10 billion people. How are we going to house these people? How are we going to feed them? We have to build, we have to open up agricultural land. We have to build highways and housing for them. And therefore, more and more, we're entering into habitats of animals like bats and other creatures that have lived for centuries, for thousands of years in protected areas. And as we grow, as we expand, we basically come into contact with these creatures that carry viruses against which we have no immunity, right? And so, the last 20 years, we have seen SARS, we have seen MERS, we have seen Ebola. Now we are in the middle of this coronavirus. If you ask me, are we going to have another such event in the next 10 years? I think it's highly likely, right? And therefore, in anticipation of those events, in order for us to be better prepared for the next one, let's build and let's improve the World Health Organization. Let's strengthen its mechanisms. Let's make it less political. Let's make sure that next time around they are not caught half asleep, and that as a result of that, the crisis is much more destructive than it could have been or it should have been.
Sir, you are a great diplomat. I noticed that every time I ask you a question, you agree with it, and then you tell me you slightly disagree with it, and then you tell me how you disagree with it. But you're doing it in such a polite way that I feel like you should be a diplomat, is all I'm saying, because you're damn good at this.
I think that I welcome your endorsement. I have been doing this quite a bit. I do a lot of public speaking and answering tough questions from people like you. So it is a combination of diplomacy and experience at this kind of engagement in this very good conversation that you and I are having. But having said that, I don't want you to think when you say that I am a diplomat, you know, that I'm not being truthful. When I say that I agree with you and I share some of your concerns, I really mean that.
I feel like you do, and that's part of why you're so good at this. I'm also fascinated at the level of a class like Dale Carnegie. I took a Dale Carnegie class on selling, and one of the things they teach is that when someone you're speaking with gives an objection, the best thing to do is restate that objection exactly like you're doing, then explain how the objection could have other ways of thinking about it, which is exactly what you're doing, and then present an alternative. And by that point, by agreeing that the person's point is very valid, Dale Carnegie teaches that you are endearing yourself to them and making the argument go away. It's now more of a, well, we already agree on this. Let's just have a discussion on this fine point here. You're also giving a great example that entrepreneurs need to listen to of how to negotiate, how to talk with people who are giving you hard questions, how to respond to a venture capitalist. You're a great role model for us in just being diplomatic in our economic situations.
Well, thank you, Jim. I very much appreciate your words, and I'm grateful for your endorsement.
Well, you're a good role model. How do we find out more about the next century and the global leadership? How do we get a copy of your book and follow you online?
You know, the book is available. First of all, you can buy the book in Amazon, Global Governance and the Emergence of Global Institutions for the 21st Century. Having said that, it is a bit pricey. We didn't set the price. Cambridge University Press is the leading academic publisher in the world. And if you're intimidated by the price, the book is available free of charge under the open access system, which they have. So you can go to the Cambridge University website site and you can download the entire PDF. So one way or the other, the book is easily accessible. And, you know, we think that this book is going to have a big, long shelf life, because the kinds of issues that we're raising are issues they are not going to go away in the next year or two or three or five or 10, regrettably.
Right.
Climate change is here to stay, and it's going to be an existential challenge for the next several decades for leaders everywhere. And so for that reason, we are confident that the kinds of questions that we're raising in the book are going to be around for a long, long time to come. And in that sense, I hope that this is not the last time that you and I talk about these things. I would certainly welcome an opportunity to review some of these issues, you know, down the line.
We would appreciate that. All right, let's put you on the spot now. We have about a minute left. What is the headline Wednesday morning after the election? On Wednesday, November 4th, what is the headline?
You know, that the results are not in yet. That because of the coronavirus, there is a lot of mail-in ballots and that will remain to be counted. And I think that we'll enter into a period of, somewhat uncertainty for many, many days. I think that unlike previous elections, we will not know the result for many days. That is my forecast, although I could be wrong.
All right. We will wait and see. Sir, thank you so much for being with us. Great talk. We appreciate it, and we do hope you come back again soon.